All right. So I started the reading series. I think I would have a theme for every reading. That's probably going to end because I can't think of that many themes. But this one's still under that umbrella. And this one is local high school teachers that are also active and published poets. So trying to get poets from all different realms of the community. So in my hands I have Poetry Magazine. I'm not a huge advocate of the magazine, but I do like a poem by John Cady in it. Oh, that's going to go on the internet. I mean, I love Poetry Magazine. Simi, can you edit that?
Oh, yeah.
I don't really like it. Does anybody know who John Cady is? He's a sort of a philosophy of language professor in Wisconsin. But he's a great poet. Is this volume okay?
Louder?
Okay. I got to take this with me, though. How's that? Oh, sweet. John Cady, Venetian Coda. Oh, I picked this poem because this is our first all-male reading. I assure you, the next reading is all-female. So I picked a poem that had a male theme. Venetian Coda. Sometimes I dream what's called the male dream. I'm going somewhere not too far away. I'm almost there when there's a slight delay, a minor detour of no consequence. But then another and another as I get farther and farther away from my initial destination, which becomes inaccessible. Before I left Berlin, I went to Venice, a city that reminds me of that dream. However close you are to where you want to go, the compound turnings of its narrow passageways and alleys carry you relentlessly away, until you dead end at a small canal that's nowhere on your map. The late wrecked century that started in Berlin, where all roads led, I thought I'd find, if not the truth exactly, then at least an inkling of some fantasy that lay beneath the placid surface of the day, the remnants of some dream so many people had to die for. Instead, I watched the boats go by and clouds traverse the sky above an unreal city floating on the water. We are sure at first that something lies beyond the facts and books, but then we realize it isn't there. Whatever lay behind the slaughter wasn't in the world, existing merely in the heart, in memory, in someone's imagination, places harboring nothing real. To try to see it is to watch it disappear, stranding you a life away from where the unimaginable began, staring blankly at your own face floating in the water. Okay, so if the readers will kindly just pick up this little clip and clip it to something on their person. I'm a high-maintenance host, sorry. This is also going on the internet. Oh, I don't want to miss anyone. Oh, God. Yes, okay. Our first reader is Rob McDonald. Although Rob graduated from Wesleyan University with a degree in mathematics, he spent most of his time there writing poetry. In 1997, he was named Connecticut State Student Poet, which encouraged him to later pursue an MFA in creative writing at Emerson College. He's been teaching high school math and English for the past 9 years and is currently the head of the math department at Beaver Country Day School in Chestnut Hill. Rob McDonald.
I'll put this to my person.
Yeah, right.
All right. To my person. All right. Put that one. Okay. All right. Thanks. About half of this is from the thesis I did at Emerson College, and the other half is a little more recent. First one is called Tampa Hi Lai. Hailai is a sport with the big baskets on your arm, and it's a very fast sport and a very dangerous sport, and tends to be played by guys from Central America, and they tend to play it in places in the U.S. where weird people bet on it, and so you've got a mix of this beautiful sport and this ugly stuff, and so I decided that would be good to write about. So Tampa Hailai. The graceful arc, the chain-link fence, the man who mumbles all night from the seat behind you, reliving the superfecta he hit last week, his bent mesh cap, the smell of cigar, the stink of the nachos his children pick over, the squeak of soles through half-hearted warm-ups, the woman who swears she was there when a ratio hit 188 on the speed gun in Newport, the mariachi tune you know you'll whistle in the car, though you're sure it's somehow offensive, the line of men, their humble bows and slavish waves, the last call for betting, the way the pelota sounds like bone, the program that says lethal and deadly, not lonely or desperate. Barando, the goat, the old vet, struggling to hide his new gut under a fresh red jersey. The drunk who yells spick when Barando bobbles. The cries of Libre and Dos from Diego, whose arms are tired, whose children are home alone, eating cereal and teasing the dog. The rebote, the picada, Solano's leaping catch, the cheers, the chula, Barando's favorite kill. The one that sends Diego to the showers to slump against tile, to call it quits. The way the smoke rises and meanders to the men's room, where a man in permapress leans in too far and stains his slacks with a stranger's urine. Motherfucker, he says slowly, and looks to you for explanation, then smiles, relieved, that something finally happened. Next one's called Tron, after the movie. Tron. I can't stop thinking about her. The girl with the tiny eyes shrugged her shoulders and adjusted her glasses with one finger as she explained that the spell check on her computer keeps changing her name to Soybean. I wanted to interrupt, tell her about my car, about the way the cruise control turns on unexpectedly, says hello, then speeds away. If she were here right now, I'd ask her why the ATM keeps giving me prayer scrolls instead of money, and why I hang them on my bedroom door, and why I feel safe at night when the car alarms go off in unison. I'd ask her if she's afraid of redemption, and I'd ask why all of my friends are getting tattoos of muted post horns. What if she shrugged her shoulders and adjusted those glasses slowly into focus with one cautious finger? I asked my brother about all of this. He sent me an email, Rent Tron. So now I sit in the flicker of silence, my name on the screen, the cursor blinking, the words check spelling highlighted, wanting to slowly relax my finger, wanting to let go, wanting to learn my real name. A new one that's a first draft, so bear with me. It's called Agnostic Sobriety. It is a small glass, and it is shaped like the glug alcohol makes, coughing into such a small glass on such a muggy night. I don't even drink, so what do I know of the smells and sounds of barometers rising, men passing out as the clock strikes one? I know that bars don't have clocks. I know that when you try to hail a cab, if you're drunk, your thumb will point to your guardian star. Of course, your star may be sick of your nonsense, maybe whispering his own confessions to Orion through thin lace clouds. Your star's got better things to do than to flash a shaft of obvious light on what's real each night. It is a small glass, and a star spangles up the sides to douse you with light, to cool your fingertips on such a muggy night. Right now, I'm lucky enough to be teaching a fiction writing class over at Beaver, and these are either flash fiction or prose poetry, but since it's a poetry reading, they're prose poetry tonight. The first one's called The Bells. I had just finished dinner with Megan at the new Mongolian restaurant, and I was walking home when I heard the music coming from the Baptist church, so I wandered in. A very tall, very thin woman greeted me, and asked me please to remove my hat, which I did. "Here's a prayer book and a little wine," she said. I drank the Dixie cup of wine right then and there, which was apparently the wrong thing to do. The woman frowned and gave me two more prayer books. I found a seat in the last pew and tried to follow along. At one point, we all stood up and recited the alphabet. Later, we counted up to 99 and then back down to 1. The whole service was very relaxing, and I promised myself that I'd make a habit of attending. As we were all filing out of the church and into the night, a man in a robe asked me if I'd like to ring the bells. He led me up a spiral staircase and onto a balcony. Through a tiny triangular window, I could see the whole world down below. I rang those bells with everything I had. The man in the robe nodded approval. I tried to contain my excitement, it being a place of worship and all, but the experience turned me into a fanatic, a lunatic. I couldn't be stopped. When they tried to pry the rope from my hands, I remember snarling at them, showing them my teeth, showing them that I meant it. And this one is called Panini. I was walking to the cafe when a woman stopped me for directions. "How do I get to Hanoi?" she asked. "Hanoi?" I said. "You're not from around here, are you?" I looked at the sun to get my bearings, then pointed her to the east. "That way," I said. "Then take a right at Erdenay." The woman hugged me, kissed me on each cheek, and headed off. At the cafe, I ordered a turkey panini, which was delicious. I could still feel the woman's kisses as I was eating. The man behind the counter seemed to notice that I was smiling. I was finishing the last bite of my sandwich when I saw the woman walk in. She asked the man behind the counter, "How do I get to Dakar?" "Dakar," the man answered. "You're not from around here, are you?" He proceeded to tell her about the Grand Mosque, the zoo, and the caramel market. He was clearly stalling, rambling about marigolds and zinnias. I couldn't take it. "You don't even know where Dakar is," I shouted, "do you?" He glared at me for a long moment, then asked if I had enjoyed the panini, which really put me in my place. And this one's called The Acorn. Yesterday, while I was digging a hole in the backyard for an aesthetically ordinary acorn, the shovel hit something solid. Immediately, I imagined a treasure chest, a box of rare coins, something that might change my life. Of course, it turned out to just be a coffin with a dead boy inside. He wasn't happy about being dug up. He kept complaining about how much the light hurt his eyes. When he noticed me admiring his pocket watch, he said, "It still keeps good time," and shook his head, making a little cloud of dirt and dust and regret. "Is there anything I can do?" I asked him, but he didn't answer because he was dead. He didn't climb out of the coffin to play wiffle ball with me, and he didn't ask me to read him sci-fi stories either. It turns out that the dead little boys in my backyard are happy to be left alone with their dead dreams. When I asked if he'd like me to bury him with the acorn, which I thought was a nice gesture, he looked at me like I was crazy, like I'd never understand. Am I loud enough, everybody? Okay, no, okay, louder. Back to real poems. This one's called Barbicide, and Barbicide is the stuff that the barber, the blue liquid that cleans the combs, Barbicide, okay. The hook-nosed barber asks all the wrong questions. He wants to know your name, how long you've been in town, and what line of work you're in. He cuts hairs one by one, dragging it out, making you sweat. Are you imagining, or does he clip an ear each time you lie? And why are there photos of all the women you love in the corners of his mirror? The whole city is silent. Your neck is bleeding. The barber smokes a butt and waits for you to fold. When you refuse to confess, the moon appears in a cream suit from some hidden back room and points coolly to the blue jar where all of the dirty combs bob, tapping helplessly at the ceiling. They stare fish-eyed at the cross. Their sins are washed away. And then a very little new one called Public School, with no offense meant to public school. Public school. My history teacher swears the first Thanksgiving was teeming with sexual tension. Sometimes I like to coat my arm with Elmer's glue, then peel it off 10 minutes later. I went to public school. This one is called Right, and it's about a bad thing that I did when I was in high school. Hitting a cat with a car. Accidentally. Right. Put him out of his misery, Steve says, because this is what bad friends say when you accidentally hit a cat one night on a foggy back road in Arundel, Maine. Steve opens the trunk when you're distracted by the impossible angles of the cat's legs, by calm eyes which do not glow, do not close, and returns with an 8-iron, the club of choice. Maybe you pray to the mist, the smell of ocean. Maybe you drive away alone, leaving Steve, golf club, and cat to dissolve and linger, to hang there, waist high, in fingers of cloud. But maybe the unreal lights in the distance become a rumbling old gray pickup driven by Del Huff, retired granite farmer, widower, cat owner, lifelong resident of Arundel, Maine. The gravel, the pine, the beard, the fog. Imagine his worn, sure hands. Imagine the way he sinks them deep in overall pockets, rocks back on heels, admires the scene you've painted. You watch those hands lift and cradle the animal, father's hands pressing smaller, smaller still, until they meet in prayer. When the cat is gone, Del Huff does not hide his smile, his moonlit eyes. And I realized that this one holds up fine on paper, but if I'm reading it out loud, then I guess I need to explain that this German word, Weltschmerz, or something like that, starts with W. So this is called definition. The spelling bee is on TV tonight, and the kids of today are showing proudly, awkwardly, what they know. What they know is the next letter, and somehow the next and the next. This is impractical beauty, magic as pointless as linking rings. They are dogs catching frisbees, chimpanzees riding unicycles. Still an impressive feat, this spelling, this dense knowledge of language. This little girl knows everything. Maybe she can end the war, cure malaria. Maybe she can answer those real questions, the ones about love and the dark pockets between planets and the dreams that don't go away. That's why we watch, right? To see the future, a glimmer of immortality in the myopic eyes of a 12-year-old. We'll never memorize Webster's, but if she can spell words she's never even spoken, never even seen, then maybe cynicism is dead. Tonight hope is reborn, peace and love are alive and well. So when she spells poesis, you can't help but smile. You can't help but imagine contagious innocence spreading from the war-torn corners to the towns terrorized by mudslides. All's well until that goat-footed schmuck gives her Weltschmerz. Until she asks for the definition, until the official pronouncer with unmistakable regret explains that Weltschmerz is a sentimental pessimism, a slight depression at the realization that reality never, never, ever lives up to our ideals. How then do we take it when, after much thought, much time and deep, true consideration, she opens on our behalf with a V and proceeds to either slaughter the Germans or be slaughtered by them? Another new one that might be a disaster. It's about starfish and movie stars, sort of. And it's called One Piece. Starfish of the 1970s wash up on the shores of Jupiter and Juno Beach, where you rediscover them, remembering that this one dated Peter Fonda, and that one had a catchphrase in the days of catchphrases. Starfish of the 1970s fill your fanny pack on the walk back home, so you feel the cold squirm of obsolescence as you wade through an ugly sunset, headed for a Bloody Mary, and another night of making confessions to the pelicans and love to the satellite dish. You can always, at midnight, buy a fresh start on QVC. You can always imagine that you don't hear those starfish slipping down the sides of your stainless steel sink. Disaster. All right. Back to the drawing board on that one. The next two are about going to Cape Cod when I was little and stuff with my dad and my family down there. First one's called Morning Walks. If you had asked at the time, I would have said it was for the baseball cards he bought me. The walks from our rented cottage to Wellfleet Center for a paper and a coffee. Maybe we saw some girls in bikinis or a Bob White in a ratty nest. I listened to the story of General Smedley Butler and the fascist plot to overthrow poor Roosevelt. Dad knew a lot about boats and seemed to head for the dock instinctively. The names of the sails, the bow and stern, starboard and port and brig. For the gulls, I tore a corner off the Danish my mother was waiting for. Sometimes he wore the shorts with hula girls and ukuleles and fake Hawaiian sayings. An old yellow lab drooled on the liquor store welcome mat, everything smelling like sun and his nose beginning to blister. I scanned the Sox box score while he finished a drink and asked for the check. Yastrzemski, 0-for-4. The slow walk home, the scrub pine, the white line, both of us balancing. Tennis fetish. I never saw a pleated skirt puff across the red clay courts at Wellfleet Racquet Club. No hollow thonk of yellow felt as it skids, grabs, stains the air with a sour horseshoe. But I traced the nets, it seems, for days, measuring their disrepair, imagining the women there years ago, the lingering scent of $100 bills. In station wagon windows, boys my age ate ice cream, making chocolate frowns as their families rumbled by in search of $2 t-shirts and miniature golf. The rust rubbed off the chain-link fence like curry powder. My father caught me with the taste still on my tongue. And then a pretty little one. It was called On Cold Nights. When I can't sleep, I open the blinds and watch the old man next door playing his bed springs like a harp. You say, oh fine, a metaphor of sorts. I say, no, he's right there, right now, playing away in his plaid pajamas, making love to those springs. And here comes the wife, apron clad, round and white as a snow globe. Here she comes singing in Italian, rubbing his bald little head with a warm oven mitt. Oh, look at him smile. Look at the way the ice melts slowly from their windowsill, riding down the building's side, becoming a tiny river that flows gladly unnoticed through town. And then a not-so-good relationship on this one. Imperfections. He and the girl he'll never marry sit in the laundromat, sipping hot chocolate, watching fractals descend. The paths they choose, the persistent decision. Is this magic, logic, all this water stretched thin and frosted? Even the simplicities are mysterious. He sees them all, the ghosts of each moment of his life, paranormal paratroopers. These frozen instants, he finds, are easier to handle in bunches. She dips her nose in whipped cream, taps his shoulder, but gets no laugh. In the hum that time makes as it passes, he watches the chaos unravel and understands the lawlessness of spinning socks. She could levitate. She knows she could close eyes and rise balloon-like, shrinking into nothing, disappearing into everything, the amorphous white sky. She feels her ears pop. Would he rescue her ankles? Outside, a plow curls a wave through its orange mouth, divides the moment diagonally with noisy precision, then spits it all out, oblivious to the geometries of comfort. This one, against my better judgment, got put on my school's website, so... So parent conferences might be interesting. Donkey as teenage son. You kneel down to check, and yes, there it is, a punk rock bracelet around the donkey's wrist, little metal pyramids, three rows wide. As the rest of your tour group clomp away down the long face of the canyon, you and your ass hang back to chat. "What's with the bracelet?" you ask, but he wrinkles his nose, kicks up some dust in that adolescent donkey sort of way. Soon he'll be wandering off at night, returning only to stare into the embers, to trace the last wisps of smoke as they bend themselves into letters, into silent curses and combinations. You're sure you've lost him for good, but when you scratch his back, he turns, sinks his sad gray eyes into yours, and drops a pile of dry apples softly at your feet. Two more. A short one called Iota. "Not even the baby toe of Island was tiny enough for her. I found a grain, half a grain of sand, thrashing out at sea. There," I said, and gave her a hint of a trace of the least of me. And this last one is called The Last Dance. It's mostly true about a trip to New York that it was a nice trip. The Last Dance. "When you wake up, a homeless woman will be staring down at you through the skylight in Steve's apartment. She will say nothing, nothing about the end of the world, but you'll see her warm, lewd smile all day. You will roam the streets of New York with your high school friends, stopping here for donuts and smiles from the Polish girls, there for a slice of pizza which will burn the roof of your mouth raw. When you blow steam like a dragon, John will snap a photo which will never be developed. Rain will not fall. Your parking ticket will not be paid. As the final unremarkable sunset is collecting itself, you'll be flipping through stacks of vinyl in the village, discovering a warped copy of Rubber Soul mixed in with the G's. Steve will convince you to keep looking. There will be four Korean men arguing on the corner when you notice how red the moon is. As the three of you file silently into Central Park, you'll be thinking about basmati rice and banana fritters, about the long drive home and the bad shocks on your Nova. You will not think of the Polish girls, and they will not think of you. A boy in royal blue overalls will feed his first pigeon. You will hear violins and zip up your sweatshirt and stop to lean on a cold copper railing overlooking a makeshift parquet floor, couples swirling down below in black and white and pink, a scene you might ignore or insult on any other day. But you will watch for hours, all of you, while the world is ending, while they dance." Thanks. One more hand for Rob. One of the minor problems with reading first is I don't have my act together. There's water if you want to post reading water. Sorry. They're over here for the other two readers. Our next reader is Michael Levine. He has poems appearing and or forthcoming in Natural Bridge, North American Review, Poet Lore, and 236. He currently teaches English at Gann Academy in Waltham, Massachusetts, and holds an MA in Creative Writing from Boston University, where he taught Creative Writing and won an Academy of American Poets Prize, and an MFA in Writing from Washington University, where he taught Composition and Poetry Writing. Among other odd jobs, writing thank you letters for Washington University's chancellor, selling women's and men's shoes, working in the Illinois Department of Transportation motor pool, bagging groceries, and detasseling corn. That's sort of erotic, for what it's worth. Michael Levine. Thank you.
Run the water.
Water, yeah, yeah. Very good. That's totally the wrong way, isn't it? Ha. Huh. Hi. Is this on? Can you hear me? Sort of. So talk really loud. I'm going to do something kind of horrible, subject you to my singing at some point this fall. So anyway, there we go. Anyway, I wrote this poem and then suddenly I became a huge Elvis fan. This poem's called Graceland, and it kind of came out, and then once I figured out what it was about, I became obsessed with him. Anyway, here's Graceland. The hard hat of the groin throbs, thumps 4-4 with the strung want and hypnotist tips, grinding the crowd into a trance. Hound dog howls across the building, filled seats, roof raised like the revival house he'd lurked behind, learning sway and fervor. Girls screaming, sex on raw display, urgent like they've never seen it. You ain't nothing but a dressed in white, his image descends from the stage into a shrieking field of ladas. The talk show host's grin quits back panic. You ain't never caught a rabbit, one show later he'll cut him off at the hips. But here, now, he's lost control, gestures frantically at the cameraman to track back, though not before boys watch how to make girls wail. Great wings beating still. His heart's juke-step rhythm knots need and awe into fever, throngs thrumming, their hands outstretched to rend his flesh. It's one sort of a Rilke-esque moment in Chinatown. It's called Chinatown Night. Chinatown winter night. Walk down any street and the windows speak a language of warmth. Clothes, patterned silks and pornography, a brothel of food. Walk down the street, signs exotic in the cold red light. People slip by in degrees. The whole town's hunkered down for a blizzard that will hit this time. Breathe in the night air and it hits you that anywhere you are, you're a ghost. The town could walk through you on its way to the future. The time you've borrowed and squandered, your life wants back. It will hurt you. You remember hurting. Ideograms, softly glittering red snow. I teach at a Gann Academy, a Jewish school, so I figure I should read this poem. Anyway, this is a poem for the new year, and it's sort of about moving to a new town. The sunset smudges like newsprint in the distance. Rosh Hashanah flares from the shofar's mouth and rattles through the dry fields. Candle smoke writes our names in the book of the new year. In Hebrew, I have forgotten. Its characters imprints of ancestral bones. 1970, a man sits at the piano, banging a Gershwin tune into the room. He imagines his family singing off-key around him. Their faint voices, the first strokes of an elegy time won't let go. Auld Lang Syne into Schoenberg, and then silence. The annual crash of his head on the keys. The Sioux men opened themselves to the world, announcing, "Today is a good day to die," meaning, "Today is the mortal day, the only day." I don't know how it sounds to the Sioux in their language, the way they hear the sounds of daybreak, the sounds of dusk. I've heard only the words sounds make in my language. Listen. Day to die, the vowel between the wind's whine and the wolf's bay. Stacks of newspapers in the moving boxes, mothballs and cornfields from an old town unfurl its history into the air of a new city. Sunset maps in the window, the spaces between them. The past kindles in a forest of frost. The winter drums build their cadences, march across darkness in the sun's wane. Sioux crunching back through the cold toward fall. The papers are in the corner now. Tonight, though, they could be leaves, shining little with what had lived there once, what colors they still held. This one started out to be a Valentine's Day poem and didn't exactly end up that way. It's called First Snow Falling. As it happened one night outside Chicago, I began crying. I was 4 and it had sleeted all night. A blackbird sang out and the sound ricocheted off the rising walls of ice and would not stop bouncing. I was 4. This dream, I think now, says something like, I can't let go of the sound of guilt, as if there is a sky crushed against the clouds and light trembles hesitantly down. I was 4 and there were apartment buildings, and the bricks danced in the refracted streetlights. I called it a memory and begged it to go away, and the blackbird repeated my song. I understood that guilt was fear, and that fear had its place in this world, shielding the sun with ice, distilling it. There was a place I remembered where the snow fell and the apple trees sang out green and red. And I remembered the word russet, having heard it once or read it somewhere. It was a dream and I was 4 then, imagining myself into the future with a blackbird on my shoulder, its heathen feathers whispering into my ear, something like the sound of my name before the first flake fell, and then the sound of my name after, in a tone that sounded like bells. I have kind of an obsession with Eric Dolphy, all these obsessions coming out. And the poem was initially called Epistrophe, but I realized that was a little awkward, so it's now Epistrophe. So this is sort of imagining Eric Dolphy, but I have this habit of imagining things that seem like they should be true, but for some reason they never are. So imagine this is an apocryphal Eric Dolphy sort of incident. Anyway, Epistrophe. The horn kept her up, she said, hooting like it was whoring. But I was fingering magic. The notes I leave out say more than what I play, and when I play them fast enough, the logic emerges, up and down, the side-to-side brush of the archaeologist dusting the Rosetta Stone before he realizes what he's touching. In E-flat, in 4-5 hard bop, a la Max Roach, Kansas City style, and I bring the scales up and up until to anyone else there just trills wonking at the top register. The mathematician sees equations, the musician's keys and modes, transposing proof into X note, the note inside the note, in and out of Greek columns, each a structure that houses divinity as it builds and divides. What is left stands as more permanent structure. The notes I drop give God a space to fill and grow into until the music inhabits all the light in the world, and all the light in the world cries out his name. This is another one of those imagined things that should exist, but doesn't. So anyway, this is an imaginary painting in an imaginary museum, but really neat watching the painting. Called Pastoral. Tough crowd tonight. One spring, a child trundled a steep meadow, pulling up every flower he could get his hands on. A man played love songs on a dark guitar and sang across the field for his lost Wanda to come home. Oh, come home, Wanda, and bring flowers to the table. The boy loved flowers like he loved nothing else, not even food. He would wrap his fat hands carefully around the stems, pause, and softly pull, then pluck the sound right in time with the guitarist's song. The man sings how he sets the table so carefully that each fork, each knife, each soup spoon holds the candlelight, holds the warmth of love in its handle tonight. And then the boy shoveled the head of the flower, and each flower after that, into his mouth like a lollipop. He hummed nursery rhymes his mother had sung to him. He liked one about the woman who lived in a shoe, and one about the woman who lived in a pumpkin, and how the dish ran away with the spoon. Oh, Wanda, I know a man who would climb up your mountain to bring you honeysuckle pie. I know a man who would bring you flowers. Oh, little boy, in 10 years you will forget how you lost yourself in the world, forgot yourself in someone else's song. The man's quick fingers freeze on the strings. The boy's staring at his hand on a stem. The sun will never set, but the field shimmers as though it's never been painted, except by the wind and the hordes of clouds that promise rain, that no other green will ever surpass this green. As long as I stand here, I can never die. I had this issue lately with my poems, that they were kind of whiny. So I called my friend Sean. I said, "Sean, my poems are kind of whiny. What? Do you have any suggestions?" It's like, put something weird in it, like avocados. So this is still life with avocados. Two avocados ripen on the lip of a windowsill. You could reach in, clutch with your eye an open room, the gold Dutch master's light stashed in bent beer bottle caps. A stark hopper white's usurped its place on the walls. Pictures have hung but won't stop falling. The glints and cracks in the glass map a marriage. Moments trap, hold the sun's rays. Pick them up. Peel their cobbled skin away. The green meats slick to the touch, rich to tongue. You could step into the kitchen among knives and pans. The fruit's as soft as fresh clay. It's up to you to make something of it, what was set on the ledge and left to rot. This is as close to a political poem as I've written. Not the last one, but this one. It's called Strange Season, which, well, you'll see. Strange season lifting into the mad hills. It settles like blackbirds on crow wires and won't let summer in. It whirls down slopes, subsumes trees, picks up a man and grounds him again 1,000 feet away. It's a dream of history, Washington's war, Afghanistan in the 80s. It slit men's throats over opium fields. It swallows years and weaves them bodiless into events. Skylines rise and take it in. Its sunsets liquid silver shimmer on the arch. The flame in the Statue of Liberty's Olympic torch. Grime settled into Bowery drunks' coats. It swells and caresses murderers' and ministers' faces. People turn and there's no one there, but that much of their lives is behind them. The United States is the new Imperial Russia. Burning bush in effigy, it becomes the flames in California's forests, the flicker at the end of a Mexican grocer's cigarette. This century is the last 60s. It wanders into temples, tired and hungry, slips up onto a menorah candle, into incense chambers, spills out into the aisles, corridors, and everywhere. In the red pen correcting students' grammar, the rage in a boxer's dire red gloves, the ethereal clouded over green of the grass and even the mute green of the violent silenced women and political prisoners, of the months-old goose shit holding fast to the sidewalks and right-of-way. It roosts and won't fly off until it needs to. It salves the wounded, recently abandoned, the jilted, the addict gone cold turkey clean. It's winds gathering waves and whelm to burl knowledge over the reckless world. It's the mirage, the miles ahead shimmer, and still further to go. This is one of those nights when I burned my hand, which I suppose could happen to anyone who's cooking Swiss chard. Really tough crowd. This is called Prometheus's Gift. It caught fire the night, its tattered edges kindled. But this is more simple, a dish rag, the water in a pot boiling as I lifted it. Her voice repeated, but simpler, that the fringes lifted the word as I lifted the pot, curling as I described what I had not seen. The stems of Swiss chard boiled, flesh softened. As she repeated, the water no longer churning, the heat lifted and set down, the dish rag blossomed. The shapes mimicked onto it, flared upward. The night, my fingers seared by flowers. Fire, she repeated, and I felt it. My fingers, heat they could not feel, then breathtakingly felt. Flesh raised in bloom. But we accepted this gift, and we sat and we ate. displaced lullaby. It's 1 a.m. at Denny's. The girl from the table beside me asks her boyfriend about his job. He sips his coffee. She's pretty, though she smokes too much. He won't look at her. She lights his earrings and two blonde hair, is oblivious to the acne that will mark him all his life. She's earnest, and he thinks he loves her, but he's scared, and he doesn't know how to tell her things yet, and she doesn't know how not to want to know. She's depending on him for something. I know her parents dream she'll be famous. They don't know what to do with this boy she likes. They don't know she loves frogs and Louis Armstrong, has trouble believing in God, wants to race cars and play chess. They don't know how to tell her they love her so much everything she does scares them. She's smoking. He is too, like we used to when we first met, and to talk to you, I'd have wedged myself between you and anything. I wish we had gone ice skating so I could have held your hands in one more way than I ever have. But this isn't our scene, and you're not here, not tonight. A diner on a small town strip. Boys with tattoos and girls with wild hair cluster in the parking lot outside, under the light pole, around fast, brutal cars with their hoods propped open, and men who never moved past stories of speed and ditching school. There's a mist falling, it seems, out of the streetlight. An engine snarls and then another, and the two cars scream toward the street. The couple hears none of this. They won't look at one another. They haven't said a word for minutes. I imagine lifting you into air and momentum, and that I can leap after you, follow you for whole seconds to the other side of the rink and catch you, spin us both around until we're dizzy, and that in all the time I've known you, I was never afraid. There's a song that goes like that, I think, but it's just a song, and my Valentine's never gets the things I want to say to you just right. I half expect her to reach over and slap him. I don't think I know why she did, but it would be right, as she'll reflect later. But she might just as well stroke his cheek, and that would be right, too. It's her move, because he can't seem to. He'll either shout something, stand up and knock their drinks over, scream that he hates his goddamn life, can't do a thing about it, and run out. Or he'll stay where he is and start crying. He knows he's blowing his chances with her, and doesn't know what to do. I want to go over and put words in their mouths, almost, but not quite as much as I want to kiss you like we did. And I remember, it's about remembering. We talked until 6 that morning, and it was winter outside, and I was late for work, and we talked some more, and I want to tell them they'll forget this night. Or they won't, because he'll forget himself and reach across the table to grab her nose like in that kids play, and hold his thumb between his fingers, and yes, smile, and she will, laugh. But they don't know how years will change them, together or separately. Separately, I think, though they could, by some fluke, persevere in ways they swore they would never let happen. But I miss you, even though there are only 3 rooms between us and you're sleeping. It's late, late, and in all the small, aspiring cities spread out between us, I miss you too much to speak. I miss you too much to think, to move. We've hit the 2-poem limit. Time to go into the hurry-up offense and see where that takes us. Until we sleep, which actually is kind of a slow call, but fake out the defense. Until we sleep. The movie finished. A stillness settled over the room. It was 12:30. It was spring, and the world had not come to its end. The towers were still gone. People were born, people died, people I loved, people I didn't. The light that lit the room was quiet. I felt happy for the first time in months. Earlier, we had walked where trees had fallen in the road, a litter of flowers like the aftermath of a crash. We walked on, time passed, night fell, we kept living. And it meant something. The whole town slept, a car passed through the quiet. The quiet resumed. Elsewhere, wars, lives changing. But there was peace here, the window thrown open, the night pouring in. We listened to it as long as we could without talking. A car passed by, our hands together. As long as I can remember, the world turned and said nothing. The air liquid with spring. Pain moved through the world. But tonight I can think it and know, and that's enough. It will return, it will recede. It's 12:30, it's spring, serenity. We're live somewhere in the world. We haven't said a word. And this is the song. I caught an image today about night. One hugeness splintered into thousands, shards, then grains. These grains became a thousand birds, which sang so loud the sound burst all light. I held my hands out. Each drop was a song I had heard years ago when walking beans those summer's childhood stores like movie scenes, dubbed over in a long-forgotten tongue. It wasn't rain that fell then, sky all blue, but snow for 5 whole minutes, melting, poured from every branch. That holy sound stretched up, itself a branch, extending toward some truth I couldn't know, and I was laughing, cold, absorbed, somehow baptized by every drop. Thank you.
Another hand for Michael. So now is the time on our show where I pass the hat and you put money into it for rent. Take another picture because there's more of you here now. In the picture, I'm
All right. Before our last poet, a couple of reminders. We usually head over to McCaskey's. The more of you that do, the closer we get to maybe being sponsored by them. They can help with rent. They thought about it, anyway. I don't know how earnestly. What else? Oh, October 7th is the next reading. And that's Anna Bozashevic Bowling and Friends from Hunter College in New York City. And that's it. Thanks again for coming. I don't even think I thanked you the first time, so thanks the first time. All right, our next reader is Chad Reynolds. Give it up. No, he's not. Chad's poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Swink, Real Poetic, Redivider, Washington Square, Meridian, Puerto del Sol, and elsewhere. He teaches English also at the Gann Academy in Waltham and lives in Somerville with his wife, Chad Reynolds.
Okay, so thanks. Listen, I'm going to try something new here. First of all, it's very complicated, so you have to pay attention. I'm assigning a 5-page paper due Monday, each of you. You can turn it in or email it to me. Let me know how it goes, okay? All right. So what I have this thing where I guess I sometimes end up writing in series. So I'm going to take all of these series and kind of mash them together. And so I'll just briefly talk about each of the series and then I'll shut up and read. So this spring I started writing these little poems and I wrote 24 of them, and it was right before I got married. And then I discovered that if you write something about marriage and there are 24 stanzas, whoa, it's an epithalamion. So this is called an epithalamion, which is a poem about marriage. That's one of them. The next series is a series I call Lines, and I'm working on this manuscript, and each poem is a kind of line. So tonight you'll get Soup Line, you'll get Lifeline, Land Line, and others. And the third series is something I was working on this summer while I was in India. And the last series comes from another project I'm working on about this kid named Victor who was discovered outside Paris, living in the forest, and they brought him back and tried to civilize him. So you get the marriage poems, you get the lines poems, you get the India poems, and you get Victor.
What a deal.
What a deal. All right. So this is stanza 4 from the epithalamion. I want to sing the gospel, even though I don't... Oops, let me start over again. Sorry. God! All right, epithalamion, this is stanza 4. I want to sing the gospel, even though I know I can't always get what I want. What does God want me to do? Probably not sing the gospel. This is a real problem. Soup Line. The crowd of skinny folks drooled religiously. Even their rags were biblical. I fought the urge to genuflect by pretending the rosary beads were really strong peas and the cross a T-bone steak I'd just licked clean. This helped me fit in, everyone else doing the same, but still I felt like a sinner. Even after supper, when the sidewalks and the curbs welcomed us back home, the guilt surrounded me like a motorcade of moving vans, each intent on carting away little overlooked parts of my soul and depositing them like second-hand spoons in some Salvation Army to tarnish in a window display for years at half price. Pedestrians ignore me, mostly. Once, my grandmother stopped to peer inside, but didn't recognize me among the mismatched silverware. I know this because she purchased me, polished me, uses me each day to slurp her lunch. This is one of the Indian poems. It's called Foreign Birds. I listen to their song outside my window and think, this could be anywhere. Here, everyone talks about God more than birds, more about death. Home, I could become anything I want, even ornithologist. I could talk about birds. Culture abhors nature, nature abhors Victor. Victor abhors himself in public, at parties. Tonight, it seems the unseen droves have come to play, and rough. Under the sheen of a halogen lamp, even hipsters snarl when he comes too close. He doesn't speak their secret code. He minnows through the crowd to bide his time for a beer beside a face that says, "Go to hell," then forgets he's there. Meanwhile, mousy couples are showing off on thrift store couches. Victor lights a cigarette and slouches in the smoke that trails in ill will. He knows we'll start an ugly scene from the chips to the salsa unless he ducks outside to breathe. Outside. Snow heaps a mile high. Demand a word in their office under the corpse moon in a new language he won't learn until too late and he's swallowed whole, packed in ice. A bitter stiff forever. This is stanza 6 from the Epithalamium. My eyes crossed looking at your bookshelf until the rows of spines looked like actual spines, a kind of reliquary, which made of me a pilgrim. In case you are wondering, that's why in the study I was bowing down. Lifeline. It's not running full bore up the crease of my palm from the top of the wrist to the sea between my finger and thumb. And there is no genie to point out how it means I'll live to 91 with 17 kids and a cat. Or how just over there an iceberg waits to hold me with its elegant arms. It's not the floaty they throw from broken ships while, below, the drowning practice their best backstrokes in Arctic water that would freeze me in a heartbeat. And does, and there is no dinghy to hoist myself into, a cube to slowly thaw all morning, adrift and in search of another boat they'd heard was in the area, steaming full speed ahead. In the meantime, my grandmother insists I pretend my palm's a mirror, but all I see is wrinkles. I tell her, "We're all dying out here. Why does she have to remind us?" "Oh, don't be such a ninny," she says. "Think about your wife. It's her birthday, and you're not even drowning." This is another one of these Indian poems. Poem. An old man pointed to the ground and said, "Remove the rocks and sand, and you will find a well." The old man pointed to a stone and said, "Remove the shards, and you will find a statue." Do you see the old man? He's pointing at this poem. Women are from Venus, Victor is from Mars. Victor, on a blind date with a woman pursuing her PhD at Harvard in cultural anthropology, should ask her to repeat the new definition of estrangement she mentioned, rather than dent glowing boredom with a violent nod toward his heavily iodized food. If he really wants to get to know this one. But he already knows this one. The thing she wants is to poke and prod him, to frame him, and hang him on the wall for her friends to ooh and ah over, learn what went wrong over, and in the morning to perform lobotomy, last rites, a tune, the end. Epithalamion, stanza 21. I woke up last night and thought, who made this body next to me? Where do I send the thank you note? Plumb line. And I guess this is kind of, well, my friend, I have some carpentry friends, so I'm stealing their parlance and their vocabulary. Plumb line. And when an item is covered in chalk and stretched taut between other items and pulled high then dropped, what it imparts onto the 2x4 can't be called a piece of itself or pieces. Itself is still contained in the item cover. The rope, the line, a conveyor of particles, a transistor of instructions, a slingshot of signs. A simple hieroglyph emblazoned on the board speaks to me of direction and distance and depth. I hear my saw buzzing in its casing, the teeth grinding against themselves for the chance to grind against something else, something that gives and goes and lets go, and the only fuss is a golden flower of pine dust that decorates the floor. My wife likes the smell but hates the mess. It is not unlike our bed. I take her there, and while she's on her back, I mark her chest with the blue-green chalk. Inside, I can hear her muscle quake. I myself am quaking. This is delicate work. Okay, so, let's see here. Now, all right. Sorry for the confusion. Got myself mixed up here. It's so clumsy. All right. This is another Indian poem. The 1 billion people in this country don't care if my bus crashes and I die. What good is one life among so many? What good another poem? It's a wonder people have kids or poems at all. If this poem were my son, would he have Indian citizenship? Would I arrange his marriage to a younger poem whose father would provide a dowry? My future daughter-in-law, how will she sound? Thinking of her, finally, I am ready to listen to the words of men. Victor doesn't understand poems, but he sees the shapes they make on the page. This is how it is with Victor. He can walk over a bridge without knowing what holds it up, or smell a tree in spring without knowing what makes it bloom. He looks at himself in the mirror and sees the shape he makes. This is stanza 23, Epithalamion. We are writing from right to left and from bottom to top. Does that mean this is the beginning? Coke lines. The body isn't airtight. Weak valves everywhere, just waiting to be breached by amateur pharmacists. The body expands like the chamber in an old fountain pen, ballooning to accommodate the stuff that soon will dribble back up onto the white page of the bed, writing upon the sheets its postmodern mortem masterpiece. The body believes heart and soul in the idea of tomorrow, when the body seeps and crusts, when the body is a dead weight denting the pillows on the couch, when it dawns on the body that whatever it put in itself yesterday that went straight through its head has cost way too much. When the body picks itself up and returns to the bedroom to read what it wrote, wrought. When the body cleans up after itself. When the body licks its wounds. When the wounds become body and the body moves. This one is another Indian poem. I have no idea what I'm doing here. It's called Riding on a Chocolate Tiger. Riding on a Chocolate Tiger. Is it milk chocolate or bitter dark? Finally, who cares? I'm on a chocolate tiger. Okay. Victor sees the forest from the trees, and this one has a, what do you call those things? An epigraph from Robert Frost. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches, wrote Robert Frost. Victor sees the forest from the trees. One could be an ignorer of birches, oblivious to birches, unaware that beyond his bedroom window sway symbols of literature. Or one could be a torturer of birches, a butcher who hacks their branches into lumber he frames into the walls of houses where a fireplace waits to burn more birch. But the worst one could be, even worse than ignorers or torturers of birches, is in fact a swinger of birches. To love something so hard, so much, it bends in half in submission, broken, begging mercy, gasping to be ignored, to be set aflame. And this is number 16 from Epithalamion. And I guess my apologies to the internet, who I'm besmirching in this poem. So now I'm going to be forever captured there, besmirching it. 16. This internet is overcrowded. We'd like to start over. At Google Maps, we press the left arrow and head west. Landlines. Our poor cross-hatched globe, a waffle iron, an iron maiden, mother of all back roads, continents, curmudgeons, settle old scores the only way they know how. March 10 paces, turn around, big bang. Gulfs rise up between them, whole oceans. We've been left what's left of their struggle, a paradise of paralysis, wheelchair envy, electric wheelchair envy. Because buses have stopped running, we commute to work sitting down with cords that have been extended. We're no longer just circling the block. Or maybe the block's been extended to circle our town, an inner city elastic loop to take us to 9 o'clock meetings and back home by 6, all while the chair is still plugged. Planes bungee jump great distances to be pulled backwards. Astronauts spacewalk on tethers. Ditto deep sea divers. We're born connected to mothers. First breaths taken, conjoined with another. There's only one free moment when they cut it. Then they wrap us in electric blankets. Two more. So thank you. This is called Indian Nocturne. And the Nocturne is a poem that's just written at night, about night. Night. Indian Nocturne. I envy night sounds. To yell is all I want into what I cannot see. What I can see says, be silent. Darkness returns every night after lights go out, like a friend. Flashlights are pointless. Forward. Listening so hard, I hear the words on this paper clawing to get out even as I scratch them in. Their impolite decibels find my new wife, who stirs and rolls onto her side. And the last poem is called Victor in New England. Live free or die, some license plates insist. But death is, no matter how he lives. They should read, live free or not, die. 1 million cars registered with obituaries, their numbers flirting with meaning, but meaning nothing except that the steering wheel could turn him off the mountain with a wrist flick, flying over the valley, trees unaware of what's coming. Welcome to the new world. Thank you.
Another hand for Chad and all the readers. And for yourself. Thank you again for coming out. This time I mean it. And join us at Bukowski's. Thanks again. October 7th, come back.